أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا ونبينا أبو القاسم محمد
صل على محمد وآل محمد
وعلى أهل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين المعصومين. Assalamu alaikum, brothers and sisters. As it was mentioned, this is my second time here in front of you. And again, it's an honor to be here, especially to talk about such events that have recently taken place in Pakistan and throughout the world. Now, 2 weeks ago, on Thursday, a very tragic and terrible event happened where two separate bombs went off and killed over 100 Shia Pakistanis in Quetta. And inshallah, before we start the speech, if we could recite a Surah Fatiha for those who have passed away and their families, after Allah salawat ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad.
Pakistan, Bahrain, Afghanistan, Iraq, Palestine, and Israel, recite
Allahu
Salawat. Now, this event is not an isolated event. These bombings are not something that has never happened before. Over the last few years, as long as I can remember, in Pakistan there have been bombings. And people have been killed. The Shia have been oppressed for a long time now. Masjids have been attacked. There's been assassinations, target killings. Shia professionals have targets on their back there. They're not safe. Doctors, dentists, businessmen, what have you. But what's interesting about this event is that the Shia of Quetta said no more. And they protested this oppression. In the past, there have been protests as well, but these protests were powerful. These protests were profound, and they were different, right? They were peaceful, 100% peaceful, right? What happened is the people, the families of the shuhada, of the martyrs of these attacks, they placed the bodies in the street. And they gathered around the bodies with their family and their friends. And thousands of other people gathered in this city protesting those who have been killed, saying that they will not bury their dead, they will not bury those who were killed in these bombs until their demands are met. And they had pretty big demands as well. They weren't small demands. They demanded that the chief minister of that area be fired because he's not taking care of his duties. They also demanded that a provincial government come in, take the place and protect these Shias who've been oppressed for so long. Now, when these protests started, an amazing thing happened. That these protests weren't only isolated in Quetta, Pakistan. Very shortly thereafter, throughout the entire country of Pakistan, these protests, similar protests started, where people went in front of government buildings and sat down and said, "We're not moving until the shuhada are buried." And it didn't only stay within Pakistan. It reached out, it extended beyond the borders. And we see throughout many countries, even European countries, and in North America, similar protests took place. And this brought about a unity amongst the Muslims. In London, I wasn't there, but I was keeping up with the posts that some of my friends were making. And they were saying that, you know, so many people gathered there, that the temperatures were freezing. Of course, probably not as much as it was in Quetta. But they stayed there for 2 or 3 days, waiting until the shuhada were buried. And this Now, what was amazing with these protests throughout the world was that it brought unity amongst the Muslims. So the Shia in Quetta, with the tragedy that befell their lives, were able to instill unity amongst all, amongst, you know, a large group of Muslims throughout the entire world. And this is amazing, because this is something that Allah calls us to. He wants us to be unified. He doesn't want us to be divided. There's many verses of the Quran which show this. وَاَعْتَسِمُوا بِحَبْلِ اللَّهِ جَمِيعًا وَلَا تَفَارَقُوا, and hold fast to the divine cord, to the rope of Allah, all together, and do not separate, do not become separated. There's verses of the English translation, verily this ummah of yours, this nation of yours, is a single ummah, is a single nation, and I'm your Lord, so worship me. Verily this nation of yours is a single nation, is a single ummah, and I'm your Lord, so fear me. There's many verses of the Quran which talk about unity. And here we see throughout the Muslim world, unity was revived. And this is something that's amazing. But it's also something that I've noticed has not been the case in our communities for a long time. Normally we see that we are concentrating on the differences between Muslims. Let's talk about Sunni and Shia unity for a second before we get into Shia unity. Now, we see a lot of times that as Shias, we're concentrating on, you know, the historical differences we have with Sunnis. And the same thing with the Sunnis. They're concentrating on the differences that they have with us. And all we're doing is arguing and bickering over these instances. Now, I'm not saying they're not important, but our concentration should be on what brings us together, not what divides us apart. Okay? I'll give you an example. When I was in the UK a couple years ago, I was there for Muharram. And I was in an area that was predominantly Muslim. I think the area, over 80% of the town that I was living in, or at least the section of that town, was Muslim, Islamic. And that being, there was a number of masjids, there was only one Shia masjid, but a number of Sunni masjids, and there was tension amongst the Muslims. In Muharram, this tension, of course, is, you know, magnified as well. So there's a small group of Wahhabis who are there, who are fanatic, you know, pretty crazy people. They tried to convert me a few times as well when I was walking on the street. But these people, what they decided to do was, a couple days before the 10th of Muharram, they made a pamphlet. And in the pamphlet was titled, Who Killed Hussein? Right, and then R.A. Rahmatullah. And then inside the pamphlet, basically what they said is the Shia killed him. You know, they had all these different historical topics and that they misunderstood, at least. And at the end, they tried to say that the Shias were responsible for his death. Now, as an academic discussion, you know, they're definitely wrong. But as an academic discussion, we could discuss this with them. But they didn't want that. They waited until hours, you know, we were mourning Imam Hussein just before the 10th of Muharram, and they put it in every house in that area. So thousands of houses, every Shia, right before they go to the majalis, they open their, you know, through their mail slot, they see this. And everyone was upset. Everyone wanted to do all kinds of things, and they were upset with this. But this, you know, these Sunnis, instead of concentrating on, you know, the important subjects facing the Muslim community at that time, wanted to concentrate on this issue only to cause fighting and to cause people to become upset and fight back. So the Shias fought back, and in their jalous, they decided to stop in front of the masjid that was responsible for this. And do matam in front of the masjid and then start cursing everyone that they could think of. And this only brought more hatred. So as the Shias started cursing everyone that they could think of, the Sunnis came and they, you know, with a loudspeaker, they started saying bad things as well, and the police had to come and break it up. Now this is an example of how not to behave, right? How we should be concentrating on the things that bring us together. In this same little area of town that I'm talking about, I'll give you a picture of the youth. While I was there and giving lectures in the masjid, a number of times I would see youth who are high on drugs come into the mosque. As I was walking to the masjid, I would see youth, Muslim youth, drunk with alcohol in their hands, trying to talk to me about, you know, various things. This is the situation of the youth, but the leaders of the community are concentrating on this fighting over historical things. This isn't right. As I said before, these things that they're fighting over are important. They have their place, right? They should be academically discussed. The truth should be clear, and that's not in doubt. But what we should be concentrating on is bringing each other together and making each other stronger Muslims, not weaker. Not fighting in front of, you know, not fighting on the streets and making the police come and pull us apart. And, you know, the police were, afterwards, the police had some very harsh words for the organizers of the Jalous, and, you know, it was just embarrassing. It was embarrassing for Muslims as a whole. So, back to Quetta. In Quetta, they were able to, you know, it was a huge victory because the demands that they asked for were met, and also Muslims, as I said, from all over came together. Now I'm sure a lot of us either, I don't know, was there a protest in Los Angeles? I wasn't here. There was one. I was in Houston at the time. In Houston there was a protest, but here in Los Angeles also there was a protest. So I'm sure many of you attended this protest and gained energy from this protest. A lot of times when we do what's right and we stand up for justice and we obey the commands of Allah, we do what we're supposed to do, we get positive energy, we become more religious and we become more active, at least we feel we should become more active. What's important is when this happens, when we reach these highs, when we go higher than what we normally are, we need to try to keep that, right? We can't lose it. If we lose it, then the same thing's just going to repeat itself. We have to try to make sure that we're able to at least, you know, not only stay at that same level, but increase and move higher so that we could prevent something like this from happening in the future. Because that's the goal. The goal is not just to sit down and for this one event, stand up for justice and then let it happen over and over again. No. What we want is we don't want this to repeat itself. Now, here in the West, there's not much, right, that we could do except for a few things. One is we could try to keep pressure on the Pakistani government to protect the Shias who are oppressed. That's something that everyone could do through various means. We should also educate ourselves about what's happening. After this event, I saw, you know, Time magazine put an article about the Shias being oppressed in Pakistan. Al Jazeera put an article. But before that, the media was completely silent. You know, many bombs happen and they don't reach any of the newspapers or media sources in the West. Many people are assassinated and no one hears about it. So, in order to keep ourselves up to date and educated, we have to strive. We have to put forth the effort. And it's important because, you know, certain areas in the Muslim world get magnified at certain times. Bahrain is still a very important movement going on in Bahrain, but it was magnified for a short period of time and then Pakistan was forgotten. We have to remember all of the places where the Shias are being oppressed and try to stop all of it. We can't just concentrate on one and forget everywhere else. Please give me a salawat to Muhammad wa Allah. Now, one more thing that we could do is we could try to figure out what prevents us from having a strong, unified voice. Right? The only way that we're going to be able to have power, be able to make serious change, is if we have a strong, unified voice of all the Shia Muslims and Muslims as a whole together. If this doesn't happen, the changes that we can make will be small. We'll have small victories here and there, but we'll be losing the war. Now, one of the things that prevents us from coming together and having this strong, unified voice is racism. Okay? And I want to talk a little bit about this. Now, first, I'm sure all of you are saying, well, none of us are racist. You know, I'm sure that's the case. But still, in our communities, at least I have seen a lot of racism. And I'll give some examples as well. But first, let's look at racism for a little bit, and then we'll come back to the protest. Now, racism, the father of racism, the person who was the first racist, the first person who was a bigot, or you know, whatever term you want to use, is Shaitan. When Allah told him to bow down to Adam, he refused. Why? Because he was arrogant, right? Why was he arrogant? Because he thought that he was better than Adam. I'm better than him. Right? We know Satan worshipped for 6,000 years. Right? And, you know, these years, it's unknown if they're earth years or years of the hereafter. Years of the hereafter, each year is equal to 50,000 years. So it could be 6,000 times 50,000, which whatever that is, a lot. Or it could just be 6,000, which is still a whole lot of years. And he worshipped so much that the angels considered him one of their own. They considered him a jinn to be part of the angels because of how much he worshipped. But all of this was destroyed. Why? Because of racism. Because he thought he was better than Adam only because of how he was created. Not because of anything else. I was created out of fire, and he was created out of clay. That's his reasoning. Nothing else. So he's the father of racism. Now I also wanted to read for you a few hadith from our imams to show you how dangerous racism can be. So the first hadith from Imam Sadiq alayhi salam. He states, whoever possesses in his heart asabiya, which is the Arabic term for prejudice, it could be, you could translate it as tribalism, racism, or nationalism. Right? Whoever possesses in his heart asabiya, even to the extent of a mustard seed, which is very small, just a little tiny speck of this, of racism in your heart, what will happen? God will raise him on the day of judgment with the pagans of the age of ignorance. So if you have not a lot of races, like you don't have to be overtly racist where you sit there and you say, you know, Iranians are so bad, or Arabs are this and that. No, just a speck of racism in your heart, just a little bit. What's going to happen is you're going to be raised with the pagans of the age of ignorance. So on the day of judgment, everyone's going to be raised in different groups, right? The good Shia Mu'min believers will be raised with the imams. And these are the ones who, you know, will be given paradise and will be happy and all of that. Now, whoever you're raised with other than the imams, you're not going to be happy. If you're not raised with the imams, you're going to be in trouble. But even then, there's degrees. There's degrees of hardship and difficulty that you're going to face. It's stated in history that some of the worst human beings that lived on the face of the earth are the pagans of the age of ignorance. So if you're going to be raised with them, you're going to have a really tough time on the day of judgment. So here Imam Sadiq alayhi salam is warning us. He's warning us that if you have just a speck, the amount of a mustard seed of racism in your heart, you're with them, you're with these pagans of the age of ignorance. There's a few other traditions, all of them similar to this. The second one from Imam Sadiq alayhi salam. Says, whoever practices asabiyya or racism, tribalism, nationalism, whatever you want, whoever practices this, God will wrap a fold of fire around them. So meaning that they will taste the fire of hell if you have racism in your heart. Third tradition is from our Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa sallam. He says this, one who calls towards asabiyya, towards racism, is not of us. One who fights for asabiyya is not of us. And one who dies on asabiyya is not of us. Now this phrase, not of us, is important. A lot of times there's a number of hadith where this phrase is used. And a lot of times we just read through them and we just say, oh, you know, this is a bad thing. It's bad. Right? But we don't really concentrate on how bad that is. And it goes back to the first hadith. Not being of us means you're with someone else. When you're raised on the Day of Judgment, you won't be raised with the family of the Prophet. You'll be raised with someone else. That's the worst thing imaginable. What could be worse than that? Where you see the imams, all the people that we've loved, all the people that we've cried about, over there with all the believers, and we're not amongst them. How would we feel? Right? How bad would that be? You can't, if you really think about that and ponder upon that, being apart from them is the worst thing imaginable. And here, one way to do that, one way to separate ourselves from the Ahlul Bayt is through racism. So now hopefully I've shown that this is an important topic. It's something to take seriously, to see if in our hearts we have that little tiny speck of racism or not. As I said, none of us are overtly racist. None of us, you know, sit down and make racist jokes or, you know, say things that are totally inappropriate. No. But maybe in the depths of our hearts, we might have a little speck. And if we sincerely look at ourselves and sincerely, you know, contemplate on our being, if we realize this, then we could try to rid ourselves of this speck. Salawat ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad.
Now there's a question, where does racism come from? Right? And it's said that racism stems from excessive nationalism. Okay? Now nationalism in and of itself is not something that's bad. Okay, we have hadith where it says "Hubul watan min al iman," the love of one's hometown is part of faith. Right, so nationalism. Now, of course, the definition of the word might be in English might be negative. I'm not sure, but having love for your hometown is not something that's bad. Now, what does that mean? Love for your hometown. Does it mean that you love your hometown even if it does bad things? Or what part of your hometown? So for instance, many of you know I'm a convert to Islam. I'm from Los Angeles, from this city. And there's things of this city I like. The weather is very nice. The weather is probably the best weather I've ever seen anywhere in the world. There's lots of good friends I have here. My family's here. You know, there's positive things that about Los Angeles, but there's also a lot of negative things. There's a lot of crime. There's a lot of, you know, sin is everywhere. And I mean, you know probably more than me. So there's good things I like, and then there's things I don't like, right? But also, I wouldn't, like, let's say someone from Los Angeles is a bad person, is a bad, you know, some gang member from LA or something. I'm not going to defend him just because we're from the same city. Right? We say, oh, you know, he's from LA, so he's a good guy, right? No. What this love of your hometown is basically, you know, you feel a comfort that you feel when you're amongst your friends and your family. A bond that you have with the other believers from that town, but it doesn't extend to the negative aspects of your hometown. Okay? Now, excessive racism, nationalism does extend beyond that. So basically what happens is this. The leaders of a group or a society or a country come together and they instill nationalistic principles amongst the people. Why? In order to create unity, right? So when people have some sense of national pride, they're unified with each other. So this is a tool that the leaders use to keep the people together. Now, when the leaders overstep this and try to say that we are better than others only because we're from this country, or only because we're from this bloodline, or only because we're from a certain race, that's when racism starts. Okay? And what they're doing is they're disregarding the value system that Allah has put in place. What does Allah say? Allah says that the only way to separate people from other people is through piety. In Kramikum, in the law at Qakum, verily the most noblest of you in the, you know, with Allah is the most pious. And that's it. So if there's any other reason why we're separating ourselves other than piety, then we're not listening to Allah. Okay? Now today, let's bring this to today. Unfortunately, I see, at least in my experience, I see in many communities that there is racism. And in many countries, alhamdulillah, I've had the opportunity to travel through many Muslim countries and Muslim communities throughout the West. And I've seen in a lot of places, what I see is the audience is 100% from a certain race. So if I go to a Pakistani masjid, all Pakistani. If I go to an Iranian masjid, all Iranian. Or a Lebanese masjid, or an Iraqi masjid, and so on and so forth. What we do is, we come, you know, immigrants migrate to the West, and then they set up cultural centers, right? Centers that feel like you're back at home. Yeah? A little piece of Pakistan in America. Or a little piece of Iran in England, or whatever it is. You get to talk your own language, you get to eat your own food, and interact with each other in the culture that you've grown up and adored. Now, that's fine, but the only problem is when you don't welcome others, then it creates these barriers, right? So if someone that is not Pakistani, for instance, and I'm only using Pakistan as an example, right? If someone is not Pakistani, for instance, and they enter a Pakistani masjid in, let's say, you know, in the United States, and everything is in Urdu, and all the food is so spicy they can't eat it, and I don't know, people look at them funny because they're not Pakistani, what are you doing here? Right? Then what happens is this barrier has been created, and this person won't want to intermingle in the community unless he has to. Now this is I'm not saying this community is like that, and I've seen many communities that aren't, but the majority are. And this is something that creates these barriers, right? I remember when I was in Scotland, a number of years ago. I was in a city called Glasgow. And in this city, there's three masjids. Okay, three Shia masjids. Two Pakistani masjids and one Arab masjid. Right? One of the Pakistani masjids is on one part of town. Then there's the other one on the other side. And then just a block and a half away is the Arab center. So they're very close, these two. I was at this one on the other side of town. I was giving speeches there. And I was asking them about, what's the situation of the Shia here? And they're saying, yeah, we have two masjids. And, I was saying, are there any non-Pakistanis? They're like, no, there's just only Pakistani Shias here. There's no one else. I said, okay. Then I went and visited the other masjid, and they took me to the Arab one. I said, wait a second, there's a third masjid here, and they're all Shias. And these guys didn't even know about them. And it's a tiny town, tiny. Right? And that's extreme. But it exists. Right? It's where people don't even consider a masjid from another race as being Shia. In one city I was at, another city, a person who is Shia, but from another country, let's say an Arab. He walks into the masjid, it was a Pakistani masjid, walks into the masjid and someone confronts him and says, so, what are you doing here? He's like, well, isn't this a masjid? I come here to pray, I've come here to listen to the majalis. And they're like, yeah, but maybe I think you're at the wrong masjid. The masjid you should be at is down the street. Now the masjid down the street was a Sunni Wahhabi masjid. And this brother was a Shia. And they sent him to the other masjid because they couldn't imagine that there was another Shia. Now again, extreme. Most people have knowledge that other Shias exist. But you see these extremes in places. These barriers are there. And it's for us to break the barriers down. Right? This is our responsibility. Especially here in the West where there's such a mixture of Shias. We need to break these barriers down. And if we do, we'll be able to have a unified voice, we'll become a lot stronger, and inshallah we'll be able to make bigger changes which would lead to less oppression of our Shia brothers throughout the world. Now I'm reaching the end of the speech here, and I wanted to quote one of the sisters who was at the protest in Quetta. Now, she's a mother who lost four of her sons. Four of her kids were killed in the blast that happened a couple weeks ago. And she was on the street, I think it was Alamdar Road, right? She was on the street next to her four children. And she was interviewed. And I want to read what she said, because I thought it was very powerful and everyone should hear it. She said this: may you oppressors, those who committed the bombings, may you oppressors know what it is to sit in the streets with four dead and innocent children. Rain falling on their faces. But we're not here sitting to show you, the oppressors, because you have unmovable hearts. Your hearts won't be changed. Your hearts are of stone. We are sitting under these skies to bear witness to Imam Hussein alayhi salam, that today we continue to give our sons in his name. And he is the Prince of Paradise, and he is waiting to welcome our sons with open arms. Now this is a very strong sister. This is a sister who was able to bear the difficulty in the shahadat of four of her children. But we should ask this sister one thing. We should ask her, what happened to the son of Sayyidah Fatima Zahra alayhi salam in Karbala? What happened to him? After he was martyred, after he was killed brutally, Fiza came to Zainab. And she came and she said she had important news. Now, what could be important at this time? Right? Everything has already happened. What else can be important? But what happened is this. All of the shuhada of Karbala were claimed. The members of the tribes would claim them and take their bodies, or, and protect their bodies. So the tribe of Hur protected his body. The tribe of Habib protected his body. The tribe of all of the companions protected their bodies. Also, the tribe of the Ahlul Bayt were protected. The tribes of the mothers of the Ahlul Bayt protected their bodies. So Ali Akbar was protected. Abbas was protected. But when it came time for Imam Hussein alayhi salam, no one was there to protect his body. So the enemies, who were devilish, they decided, it's not enough to kill Imam Hussein alayhi salam. Rather, let's torment him in the hereafter. Let's torment his family. And they took their horses and they went to his body and they trampled over his body with their horses. But it didn't end there. The next day, the 11th of Muharram, they gathered all of the family of the Ahlul Bayt. They got Imam Sajjad, who everyone knows was sick. It's been said that Imam Sajjad on Sham Qariban went into sajda, went into prostration, and he didn't get up till the next day when they forced him up. They forced him up, they chained his arms, his legs, and they put a neck brace on his head. Now it was said that this neck brace was too big and it would fall off. The Imam was too frail. So these devils, they figured a way to keep it on his neck. And they took nails and they hit the nails into his flesh, making sure that the neck brace would stay on. So the Imam is bloodied. Imam Sajjad is full of blood. The women are now gathered around and led through and are starting to be led. And these people, these devils, they say, let's torment them some more. Killing their family is not enough. Let's make them walk through the battlefield and see their dead. So they drag the women through the battlefield, making them look at all of the bodies of the people who were killed. Finally, when they reach Imam Hussein alayhi salam, it said that Zainab, whose hands were tied behind her back, fell on her brother. Now you can only imagine what she whispered to him. Allah knows that. But I'm going to leave you with one thing here. Just one thing and then I'm going to go. It was said that because her hands were tied behind her back, she didn't have her arms to break her fall. And she fell like Abbas right on her face. Inna lillahi wa inna ilayhi raji'un.